with temperatures forecast for the low 70s for the rest of the day and to cool off into the 50s tomorrow. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features dealing with the challenges of climate change and El Nino. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Mwiza Muntali. The music in the background is in a mellow tone by Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, commemorating Duke Ellington's birthday, which is April 29, and Jazz Appreciation Month and International Jazz Day, which is April 30. In recent years, the impact on the African continent of climate change has been demonstrated by the increased frequency of devastating cyclones in Southeast Africa, such as Cyclone Freddy in 2023, or the Sahel and West Africa's heat wave of late March and early April 2024. Parts of the continent are also being adversely affected by El Nino, which is associated with a rise in temperatures. In a report released on April 18 this year, 2024, the World Weather Attribution notes that El Nino is a key driver of the current drought in Southern Africa. According to news reports, the United Nations recently noted that Southern Africa has an estimated 20 million people who face acute hunger. As we commemorate Earth Day, which was on April 22, today the show focuses on the impact of climate change on the African continent, the negative role of multinational corporations, grassroots solutions to adapt and to mitigate climate change, and more. Also highlighted is the drought in Southern Africa escalated by El Nino. Joining the show are Anne Miner, National Coordinator of the Biodiversity and Biosafety Association of Kenya, and Estacio Valoy, an investigative journalist based in Mozambique, and he is with the Center for Investigative Journalism, CIJ. Here is the conversation. Anne Miner and Estacio Valoy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's a pleasure.
Yes, and I should say welcome back to both of you. You've come on the show at different times before in the past, so we're delighted to have you on to speak about this important issue. I wanted also, before we get into too deep in the conversation, if you could describe the general environmental outlook in Africa in general, and also your specific region or country. I'll start with you, Anne Miner, in Nairobi, Kenya. If you could just give us a broad overview of that environmental outlook in the continent, particularly in your region and or country.
Thank you very much, Mwiza. As you are very much aware, climate change is a real reality in Kenya and indeed in most parts of the world, and Africa particularly, and Africa not being able to cope very well with the challenges. Maybe I can start with the recent happenings. In Kenya, we usually have two rainy seasons. The long season begins in around March to June, and the shorter rains are in October to December. So last year, we had gotten a warning that we're going to have El Nino, the drier, I think, La Nina part. But interestingly, in the December, in the October-December rains, they were not that bad, and most of the parts of the country got a good harvest. But when you compare with Southern Africa, there's currently a very bad drought in Malawi, Zambia, Zimbabwe, because the rains were not sufficient. Unfortunately, a lot of the agriculture practices are rain-fed. But now this year, starting around end of March, in this April, we're having a lot of floods in the country. Areas that have not experienced floods are now facing many challenges. What is very interesting is that even in areas that are considered to be very safe or where the upper classes of the society live are now facing the challenges, even in the cities, with the destroying of the roads and the flooding of homes. The rain now is becoming a bit of a challenge because the farmers who had planted and almost now the maize and the beans and the crops are being weeded are facing challenges because their farmlands have been flooded, and this is leading to drastic losses. But what is also interesting, if you look at the global level, for example, we've been seeing a lot of on the social media and even in the mainstream media, the floods that were unprecedented in Dubai. And you can see the challenges that a country like Dubai faced, which is far much richer. The challenges in Africa are worse. People have lost their lives. Homes have been destroyed, and communities are really struggling. Right now, as I'm speaking, the rain has just started suddenly, and it becomes a major source of concern because Africa's ability to adapt and mitigate against climate change is not that strong, and causing a lot of concerns. Even last year when we had the Africa Climate Summit, promises and promises are made of funding to adaptation, to mitigation, but still it does not reach the very needy in Africa.
Thank you, Anne, for that overview. And we'll probably get back to you to expand on some of the things you just said. And now we also want to get Estacio Valoy, who's with us in Pemba, Mozambique. If you could also give us a general overview of the environmental outlook in the continent in general, in Africa, and also your specific region, the country, in particular what's happening in Mozambique presently.
The situation is not different than what our colleague just presented. We, for one side, we are facing droughts, on the other side, floods, while we are claiming for lack of water, sandler, we have a drought which we could not even control it. We've been having tropical storms, where we did. In terms of consequences, we had the destruction of several infrastructure, where displaced people. Until now, if we talk about Mozambique, we still have several places with concentrated water. Somehow, people living surrounded by water. We look to some cities. We face the same situation as well. Some people even use small, let's say small canoes in order to cross from one side to another, even from the house to go to school. Seems like a joke, but it's reality which happened. What exactly demonstrated what's currently happening. And if we look in terms of the water, we look to this example, the temperature has been increasing, and this has been happening for a while. We see the fishermen claiming about the situation, and that this also affects the marine life. A part of it, we also have several investment, or better to call it funding, on climate issues. But we're still facing the same situation when we talk about management of all this process in terms of assessment as well. We had an example recently, some of the developed countries, as my colleague was mentioned, where they end up facing the same situation. But when we talk about Africa, we end up being the main victims for decades. And some of these summits which have been held and hold end up coming with no satisfactory answer for what it's our goal or what should be done.
Thank you, Sasio. And I wanted also to expand on what you, the two of you have just talked about, the drought which is taking place in Southern Africa, particularly. And this is the El Nino-induced drought that's affecting, as you mentioned, countries such as Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. And those countries have declared national emergencies. What other measures must be taken to deal with this situation? I'll start with you, Estacia, because since Mozambique has declared a national disaster, just like Malawi and Zambia, neighboring Malawi and Zambia, have issued, what other measures do you think that the government should take?
I do remember someone telling me that sometimes the problem is not about the funding or, let's say, the investment. It's how the system works and how this money end up being spent. The fact of declaring emergency is not enough. Where to find a better way on how to deal with it? Because somehow we've been looking to the same situation in the past, and we still face the same thing. I will give you a clear example. If you look, example, to the seed management construction, I will start from my hometown or come from Maputo. I'll keep going up. The way how we've been constructing our house, example, we end up blocking the way or the way out or the channels which naturally have been the water channels. We end up blocking it, then at the end of the day, we end up having our seat completely flooded. So start with this point. Our governments must come with a clear plan when we talk about construction of houses, seat, a good management plan in order to avoid to have all the cities flooded because the water find no other way of going or end up in the sea. We do have a challenge example when we talk about countryside. Usually, touching to the same point, we end up with the lack of water channels as well. And what happened is that this same water end up flooding. Example, recently we had flooding in the way some of the farmers end up being stricken by these floods. Camps of rice in Gaza province end up being flooded. We talk about 7,000 hectares of rice. And it has been happening mainly because we have not been investing, example, in this kind of infrastructure which can facilitate, because we do know that every year, somehow we are going to face the same situation. And the mitigation, prevention, these are the required thing instead of declaring emergency situation.
And I also wanted to find out about the drought situation. What other aspects of government measures would you like to see beyond the declaration of the emergency, as this connects to drought? I understand about the flood as well. That's a great great point to be brought up. But also dealing in some parts of Mozambique, there's also the drought situation. So, what measures do you think that they should do beyond the just stating the natural disaster emergency?
I mean, the same way as I was saying, when we're dealing with floods, we should also look to the drought issue, because if we cannot as well contain this water in our dam, we'll end up having a drought because we cannot feed all these camps, because we have no proper irrigation process. We have no proper tools in order to keep this water and use this water when it required. So We are talking about a knife with both edges, with sharpened edges, where we have to deal with both sides. We cannot only look to one side. And as I was saying, we cannot look to this situation only when this happened. And that this is what they've been undermining our social, economical development. I'm talking mainly, humanitarian as well, because at the end of the day, we'll keep begging to donors so they can keep funding us with millions of dollars. At the end of the day, these millions of dollars will not be enough or will not solve this issue. But as I was saying, if we're able to minimize the situation, to mitigate situation, we can tackle this issue in the proper way, because when we mitigate this issue, mainly we look to the things in advance. What's going to happen in 10 days, in 10 years? What's going to happen? And if we're not able to do it, we'll keep facing the same situation every day. And as we were now, with this draft situation, we are facing the food issue, because some of the place will not be able to produce enough. And some of the place are in this exact moment waiting or expecting food for other places to come. But we could have had avoided it if with a good plan.
And Anne, I wondered if you could chime in on what Estacio has talked about. This was a particularly in case in point in Mozambique in particular, but also as you're looking at the situation in Kenya right now with the developing of the floods in Nairobi. I saw some images earlier, and you had mentioned that this time around, it looks like it's, for lack of a better word, more democratic in terms of how it's affecting the population. It's not just affecting the poor communities, but actually the well-to-do communities as well. And if you can just expand on that, what beyond the, just the when governments issue national disaster alerts, what other things do you see that should be done locally, but also on the international level?
Thank you very much. Like I said, in previous cases, a lot when there was rain, the informal settlements were the most affected. But now we've reached a situation where the upmarket areas, the middle class, are really being affected. There was a case of a block of flats that was built along a waterway and in a place called Athi River. And the whole block is now flooded. All the houses on the ground floor are flooded. The people cannot get out to get their cars out. There are sick people in there. So even in terms of our planning, there's a major challenge as African countries, because the government approved the building of those flats, knowing very well that it sits on a waterway. Now that the excess rain, the river regains its original pathway, and now causing the floods. So corruption is also a major challenge in Africa. Even among the road construction, we are not doing enough. For example, there's one area where there was an issue of where some Chinese company constructed a road, but did not put in place measures for putting drainage. Just like the case you saw, for example, in Dubai. Dubai never thought they would have such kind of rains. Of course, there are issues where they're talking about there's been a cloud seeding, which is a way of playing around with the environment to get rain, but it's backfiring on them because they're trying to create the rain, but it's causing storms and has caused excessive flooding. So it is important that also our government, in terms of planning, does not become reactionary, but plan ahead. For example, all this rain we are having, and we hear the forecast is going on up to June, the government should have put in measures to build more dams to harness this water, because unfortunately, most of the agriculture in Kenya is still rain-fed. So this water will end up to the ocean, the Indian Ocean. And again, we'll go back to the cycle, drought, floods. And now they have become more prominent because of climate change how much are we doing enough? Last year, the government had begun a process of where there were people were given a day off to plant trees, but we haven't seen that happening much this year, and yet it's the rainy season. So in terms of planning, in terms of infrastructure, improvement of infrastructure, issues of how do you ensure that our waterways are not tampered with, the riparian areas, people do not tamper with them, and even at the global level, more funding into mitigation and adaptation measures, which is very important, because at the end of the day, the industrial world, the Europe and the US have contributed more to climate change than China's. But now you have these notions where now we are talking of carbon credits, where companies in the West want to continue polluting, producing, and releasing carbon in the air, and coming to Africa and having this, what they're calling carbon sequestration measures and carbon credits. But in terms, when you look at the end of the day, of the money that's going to a farmer's pocket, yes, planting the tree is very good, but also we need more funding to support the farmers. If they're going to do this and take care of the trees, it's important, because one analysis we did like 12 years ago, when the carbon issues of carbon markets had begun, we saw that a farmer was getting in a year less than about $10 in a year, an individual farmer. But at the end of the day, the farmer needs to benefit from that, because we are supporting the earth, the global ecosystem, to be able to deal with the climate change challenges. But also the West needs to take up responsibility. In Africa now, there's a big move, even in Kenya, to move to sustainable energy sources, solar, wind power, and all those. And how best can we make them cheaper, this infrastructure and the innovation, so that we reduce the amount of wood fire that we are using, or electricity that mostly, like in Kenya, is produced through hydroelectric or producing them from wind power. But wind power is a much better option. Mostly it's hydroelectric. So that we're able to cope with these challenges. But also the funding is very important in terms of improving infrastructure, supporting communities to move towards more energy efficient sources that are clean.
Again, that's Anne Miner. She is the National Coordinator of the Biodiversity and Biosafety Association of Kenya. And also with us is Estacio Valoy. He's an investigative journalist based in Mozambique, and he is with the Center for Investigative Journalism, CIJ, and focuses a lot on environmental issues. We're looking at dealing with the challenges of climate change and El Nino. And I wanted to also expand a bit more on what both of you have brought up, is about the early warning systems. There are early warning systems in most of these countries locally, they don't just depend on foreign researchers, scientists as well. As you mentioned, I think it was Anne mentioned that there was some warning earlier about El Nino. And I even heard it, even in the case of Malawi, they even did warn people much earlier before the season came about. How would you see, what type of solutions would you like to see in place within the government infrastructure to make use of their own information? Because I think most of the time when people talk about the continent, they forget there are local researchers, scientists as well, who are looking at these issues, and are they being listened to enough? I don't know if I think I'll start with Anne, or if you can continue, and then Estacio can chime in.
Thank you. We have institutions that are have qualified scientists that give early warning systems, like in Kenya, the meteorological departments, and there are different even international agencies, even the IGAD in the country, which give all these regular updates. Unfortunately, often they are not taken seriously. So the government does not prepare very well beforehand. And that becomes a major challenge. But also, these institutions need more funding to improve in terms of the infrastructure at the local level. But also, it is important that also our governments take heed and listen to this kind of information. Maybe now, like I was saying, in Kenya, the middle class and the upper class are really being hit by these floods. We are seeing upmarket areas being flooded, families being forced to move out. Maybe now it's time to take up the mantle and ensure that we listen, we set up proper infrastructure and systems to ensure that communities are able to cope. It's no longer an informal settlement issue or the poor who suffer. But at the end of the day, even with the floods, we are going to lose the crop. The government will soon maybe next year begin asking now for food aid. We are seeing it in Malawi, we are seeing it in Zambia. And so building the kind of infrastructure that even when you have plenty, you keep. And some of these challenges began way back in the 80s when the World Bank began all the cost structure adjustment programs. And they told African governments that if you're producing maize and you have excess in your granary, sell. If it's hunger, you buy back from the world market. When you go back to the world market, the price has gone up. And so it's important that also issues of sovereignty are really, food sovereignty are really embraced. And even as we embrace sustainable agricultural practices like agroecology, it calls on harnessing what we have. How do we harness this water? That at the end of the day, we have so much water in this up to June, but when it comes to August, all the water has flowed down to the Indian Oceans and communities now cannot produce. When you have the sun in plenty, you can be able to harness, build small dams, for example, in sub-counties so that communities can use those dams to grow crops all year round, and we are able to feed our communities. Because at the end of the day, when your people are hungry, then it becomes a major challenge to the government. And we see now with lots of issues related to the high cost of living, how do people now afford food when they lose their crop? So it is important that all these are put in place and countries prioritize food as a security issue, as a national security issue, so that we can protect even our communities against such kind of calamities. Thank you.
Estacio, if you could come in and also...
adding to it, I think based on what I saw in some place, we have a community people producing food, whatever community people engage in activities or in program and projects related to environmental issues, and they're doing well. And some of these communities have been receiving funds directly. They are no longer waiting for the government to fund them directly. Even this foreign organization, they started funding these communities directly. It means that whatever people are able to do it, to develop certain projects, and if the government look to this kind of people and involve them more, not only to be with this community when we're facing the situation of floods or drought, but to work with them on this alternative, because these communities do have alternatives for a better production, for a better way on tackling the climate change. We saw the kind of different types of agriculture which they've been doing, and they've been surviving someplace to drought. Indeed, we need technology, but we also need to associate it to some traditional parts, because these have been working. If you look to some of the counts, despite the recent situation, example, we look to China in terms of agriculture production, in terms of using this water, to contain this water in order to boost the economic or the production. We had examples even in deserts such as Libya at times, where they are not depending for other place or for other accounts for their own agriculture economy. So I think it's possible to do it. And my colleague already had other several issues from, I mean, corruption, as I was saying, is not about the investment or the funding. We can have a billion funds, billions and billions. The point is how the system will work with this money. And all these decades, we saw it. And that we saw the consequences as well of this bad management, lack of attention, corruption as well. But we cannot only look to corruption around all around our places. But we saw it. And now we're still in the stage where we are today, facing the same situation from yesterday. And what are we doing now? We're still doing, behaving somehow in the same way. And if, I mean, when we look to this kind of issues, even when our governments do have money, they always rely or believe somehow this problem has to find an organization. No, FAO is going to come, we'll solve it. When you talk about draft, don't worry, we have that organization. Mainly, some of the governments are not interested in developing the country, if not develop themselves. I mean, develop themselves, I'm talking about the group of people. If look to Mozambique, to this situation, I do know that some of the situation comes from the Portuguese settlement, but in general, is to look to the current government or the government which has been ruling all these decades in terms of minimizing issue which was where possible to minimize, nothing was done, as I was saying. It's looking more to the internal issues, political party issues, instead of looking to the country in general. And once again, the community and the people still left apart of the development.
You're listening to a portion of a conversation that's focusing on the impact of climate change on the African continent and the negative role of multinational corporations, grassroots solutions to adapt and to mitigate climate change, and more. Also highlighted is the drought in Southern Africa, which is escalated by El Nino. The discussion is with Anne Miner, National Coordinator of Biodiversity and Biosafety Association of Kenya, and Estacio Baloy, an investigative journalist based in Mozambique, and is with the Center for Investigative Journalism, CIJ. The music in the background is Nakuru Sunshine by Christine Kamau, commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month and International Jazz Day, which is April 30. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
Thank you, Estacio. And I wanted also Anne to expand a bit more on some of the what Estacio talked about in terms of what some of the communities are doing, because we also want to look at the solutions which are there, which are people, what people are already doing, whether it is whether it's directly from institutions or community-based grassroots solutions. And particularly, I know you, Anne, you're involved with food sovereignty issues. And if you could expand on how that movement has taken off and some of the success stories or some of the examples of what people are doing to adapt and mitigate under this current condition of climate change, and even El Nino, and how that could be expanded if there is more coordinated response within the formal government structures.
Thank you very much, Mwiza. In Kenya, I work for an organization called Biodiversity and Biosafety Association of Kenya, which is a network, an NGO, And we have been working with communities on the ground, especially those that are in the drier parts of the country, to support them in building sand dams in their own, those who have expansive land or shared sand dams, to be able to harness water. But on a broader perspective, in the food sovereignty movement, we have embraced what we call agroecology. Agroecology is brings together all these sustainable agriculture practices, organic agriculture, permaculture, and harnesses them so that communities can benefit from them. And so when you talk about agroecology, we are bringing it on board as a practice, as a science and a social movement. And we are embracing what the farmers know and bringing in the science for innovation. For example, how do farmers, are they able to harness small equipment and affordable to be able to cultivate a larger piece of land? Issues of biodiversity, having an integrated and mixed cropping, and that has really helped. And part of this is, how do you harness water? Apart from now, when we're having a lot of water because of rains and floods, there's a point where there are drier parts of the year. In agroecology, we also learn how to manage gray waters. For example, the waters that are coming from the kitchen, from the bathrooms, water that can be recycled and be used in the farm. We are working with communities to do that. If the communities, most of the rural farmers, try to have some livestock, how do we harness biogas to be able to use clean energy for food, as opposed to cutting down on wood, which is a degradation of our environment, and also is not very clean fuel for especially women who spend so much time looking for that. So the use of biogas, the use of managing their farm in a more sustainable way, because at the end of the day, the average farmer is over 50 years in Kenya. The younger people are running to the cities looking for the so-called white-collar jobs. But now we also trying to bring on board the youth by bringing the aspects of agribusiness. So you find in areas where we are getting very good successes, where you tell the youth, you can work with your parents because you are more tech savvy to even sell their produce, these that you're producing organically in an agroecological way, and support them in selling them to the cities, using different apps, using WhatsApp, using communicating with your friends, and even the establishment of what we are calling organic markets, where people can come and buy, but also leveraging on this social media and the technology to sell. And so that is creating a difference. But civil society is still a small portion of the people supporting this transition. One of the things that we saw we struggled with when we were transitioning, when we were promoting agroecology, is that there was lack of policy to inform or direct how we practice agroecology. And so we've been working in some of the counties, and one of the first counties in Kenya, Murang'a County, has passed an agroecology policy and act, where they have begun to look at ways of how to support. This area has different zones, and there are some zones where they produce avocado, they're producing organic avocado, they are producing horticultural products. How do you get it certified in a cheaper way for the farmers? But also at the national level, Biba Kenya, with other members of civil society, we are leading in the development of a national agroecology strategy under what we call the Intersectoral Forum on Agrobiodiversity and Agroecology, which is hosted by the Ministry of Agriculture in Kenya. And this is going to be very important. We hope to launch it this year. We are at the final stages of finalizing it, so that it can inform government policy and direction, because often government will even put money where their policy and their direction is directed at. And so what we call for is embracement and working together, because government at the end of the day is the biggest spender. It will be able to build better dams. It will be able to support, remove taxes on, for example, solar energy, support even in biogas and other alternative energy sources of energy. And this is going to be vital in ensuring that we reach a point where we were eating not only food, but food that's culturally acceptable and food that is safely produced. Thank you.
Estacio, I don't know if you wanted to add on or expand on with the communities you had mentioned that are working, just as Anne has talked about the communities in Kenya. If you have examples of communities in Mozambique which are working to adapt and mitigate issues of climate change, and also as we were talking about El Nino, things that are possible solutions on a wider scale, but you see it on smaller scale within in Mozambique.
We have a place down south, once again in Gaza province, the Lower Limpopo irrigation system, where they've been able to couple this issue by having funds, and they're saying they were affected by floods. And they were even able to sell, as I remember, the rice which they were producing. We look to this stage of the Lower Limpopo irrigation. We go example to Zambezi province. If you look to the region of Kilimani, moving to Nkwadala and so on, is a complete different. It's opposite, because there's a place where we do have not only rice production, but with no real access to the market. But we also have a different type of food which they've been producing. But unfortunately, there's no industry. And by not having industry, they end up having a lack of funds in order to develop or to come with the strong associations we call it cooperatives, to produce this kind of to transform this kind of fruits which they have in that side. And it means that for one side, we do have these communities which are an example of good development, but from the other side, we do have this kind of communities which they can't even move forward. So we have to find a kind of balance. It means that it's possible to tackle this situation by boosting these communities. And as I was saying before, these communities are able to do it. And we do have a fact that they've been doing it.
Thanks, Estacio, for that, for those points. Before we go, I just wanted to find out the challenges when one deals with multinational corporations in various countries who have been very much part of the problem in climate change, and they've exacerbated climate change. How do societies deal with them on the ground with multinational corporations? I know Estacio has worked a lot in looking at the extractive industries and their destruction in Mozambique in the environment. What are if you could expand a bit more on the challenges that people face with multinational corporations as they try to tackle climate change issues, Estacio? First, we'll start with Estacio and then come back to Anne.
Indeed, when you talk about multinationals and what's been happening all these years is that they've been, in fact, devastating several places. And the impact of environmental issue, it's high. And at the same time, it's a paradox. On one side, the same multinationals are coming in the sense that they want to introduce alternative energy, but at the same time, the ones which are still poisoning oil, undermining the environment. So it's a paradox. This is one side. Of course, when we talk about it, we have to come with clear policies when we talk about these multinationals, because we do know that the multinationals have more power than the government. And that when we do associate this issue of corruption, greed, we end up having the governments, not exactly looking to the sovereignty of the count, but exactly to what they are going to benefit from this issue. We have communities today which were forced to leave the areas. We have communities or fishermen communities which they became farmers because they were moved from the seaside or from the ocean, let's say in this way, into interland or inside where these people do not know how to use a simple axe. They don't know how to farm. So how are these people going to survive? In the same way, there's no mitigation, and the kind of devastation, not all by chopping trees because they want to mine, but also the kind of products which they use in the profession, the kind of techniques which they use, so end up undermining the entire area. When I'm talking the entire, I mean that from the ocean, if you look to the sea, we realize that it's concentrated or does concentrate considerable number of fishery, I mean food for the people. We go to the land, we also look to the same scenario. And some of these companies are not taken into account by our local governments. Recently, I'm looking to a Chinese company in Maputo where some of the local organizations have been claiming about pollution. Example, the case was taken to court. The next day, this same company was allowed to continue producing or continue construct. The next day, it was in court again. And usual, these multinationals end up involving government people. So I think we have to start not look to the government in general, I mean, in some points, but look to each individual from the government who is a part of these multinationals and start also tackle the things from there. Because sometimes we do blame, I'm not saying we don't have to point the finger. We must point the finger to the government always. But sometimes we have to go direct to those who are involved, those in power, who are involved with this multinational, who at the end of the day end up forcing the government in general not to take measures against these multinationals, because we do find these people inside these companies. And if we don't look to this issue the proper way, we'll keep facing the situation which we are facing now, and we'll have what is called the civil society organization look to the issues, end up with no voice, because now the government is exactly curbing or avoiding this organization, journalists and other people, example, to intervene in this kind of issue, or not exactly to consider what these organizations have been saying. Sometimes these organizations have to find a way in order that the government can hear their voice. Sometimes they have to press charge outside Mozambique. It means that the local government is doing that. So we have to come with this kind of measures. And the other thing is the kind of contract which where the government have been signed with these multinationals, at the end of the day, end up benefit these multinationals, and government end up doing that or with no space to act against the same multinationals. And the same scenario of communities suffering, losing their land is for the multinationals. We do have multinationals like for example, for Gemarok, which they end up getting a concession of these communities. And these communities are not benefiting from this concession. And the other issue is these same multinationals had to cut down trees so they can mine. So where this community will go at the end of the day, with no social economic benefits, environmental damage, what they're going to do? And at the end of the day, these same community people, because they go inside, let's say, the mining, because they have a lack of agriculture, no incoming, they go in to explore these same rubies. And that they call them thieves, criminals, in their own soil.
Thank you, Estacio, for that. And I wanted also, and if, I wondered if you also could have further comments on the issue of the multinational corporations and climate change.
Multinational corporations have been one of the biggest polluters. If you look at, for example, look at the Congo. The amount of destruction going on in the Congo forest and being facilitated by multinationals and some of the developed countries using mercenaries is very distressing. Congo is said to be the second biggest lung of the world after the Amazon in terms of absorption of the carbon emissions, but also the corruption that goes with it, because the multinationals have huge monies or huge funds, and they're able to corrupt even the system. So they are able to access resources that are not available. For example, if you look at the issue of water, right now we're talking of floods, but soon we're going to be talking of lack of access to water. And what you see with some of these multinational corporations, the likes of, let me not mention them, but some of these big beverage companies, they are going in the name of sustainable, or what they call corporate responsibility, accessing some of the cleanest sources of water because they want to continue producing poison that is being fed to our communities.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation which focuses on the impact of climate change on the African continent, the negative role of multinational corporations, grassroots solutions to adapt and to mitigate climate change, and more. And we had this conversation as we commemorate Earth Day, which was on April 22nd. Also highlighted in the discussion is the current drought in Southern Africa, escalated by El Nino. The conversation featured Anne Mina, National Coordinator of the Biodiversity and Biosafety Association of Kenya, and Estacio Valoy, an investigative journalist based in Mozambique and is with the Center for Investigative Journalism, CIJ, and has written extensively on environmental issues. The full conversation will be on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Winds of Change by Jimmy Dulu Dulu, commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month and International Jazz Day, which is April 30. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shaanana Hussein Alamin, looking at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East. And that's followed by the women's collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice from the Kichi Taifa. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineer Michael Nasella. Thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funan Gonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you with a closing song entitled The Secret Life of Plants by Stevie Wonder, commemorating Earth Day, which was April 22nd. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe. I can't.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, April 24th. Here are some headlines. President Biden today signed a $95 billion foreign aid bill passed by the Senate last night after months of debate. It includes $61 billion for Ukraine, $15 billion in military aid for Israel, $9 billion in humanitarian aid for Gaza and other war-torn areas, and $8 billion in security assistance to deter Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific. The legislation also includes language to force the Chinese owner of TikTok, used by more than 140 million Americans, to divest from the popular app or otherwise face a ban within the United States. The White House had for months pleaded with lawmakers to approve the additional aid for Ukraine in particular as it fights against Russian aggression, but some conservative Republicans had pushed back against providing the additional aid. In state news, Tennessee House Republicans yesterday passed legislation to allow some trained teachers and school staff to carry handguns, despite pleas from students and gun reform advocates to defeat the bill. Dozens of protesters in the galleries began chanting, "Blood on your hands," as soon as the legislation passed, prompting the House Speaker to order state troopers to clear the galleries. Four Republicans crossed the aisle to join Democrats in voting against the bill, with another three abstaining from the vote. Still, the measure easily passed through the House and is all but guaranteed to become law within weeks. Armed teachers, who will be required to undergo training that some opponents have argued is not intensive enough, will be allowed to carry handguns in their classrooms and in most campus situations without informing parents and most of their colleagues they are armed. In more legal news, the Supreme Court is taking up a high-stakes abortion rights case on whether hospitals have an obligation to provide abortions to women who are in medical emergencies. The justices heard arguments today on whether federal law requires emergency room physicians in Idaho to perform abortions to stabilize pregnant patients experiencing a medical crisis. The state's near-total prohibition on the procedure only allows doctors to end a pregnancy to save a mother's life and makes no exceptions if only her health, but not her life, is in grave danger. While a ruling in the case will apply to Idaho hospitals, it could set a precedent for more than 20 other states with near-total bans on abortion. And nearly 40% of people in the United States live in areas with unhealthy levels of air pollution, and the country is backsliding on clean air progress as the effects of climate change increase. That's according to a new report released today from the American Lung Association. Their latest State of the Air report shows that between 2020 and 2022, 131 million people were exposed to unhealthy air quality. That's almost 12 million more since the last survey a year ago. The data also showed that people of color are more than twice as likely than their white counterparts to live in communities with poor air quality. Extreme heat, drought, and wildfires are among the factors that have contributed to the increase in deadly air pollution, especially in the western part of the country. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 71 degrees.